live today. Please join us for this historic WBAI Salsa Dance Fundraiser at SOB's on Friday, November 11th. For more information, visit WBAI.org, SOBS.com, or call 212-243-4940.
My name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it, and I love that.
I have to celebrate you, baby.
Yeah. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to De Niro, but I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra, and since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem, all of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Brought me back to that McDonald's, took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down 8th Street, off-white Lexus, driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm up at Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I'll live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my tie. Sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets, give me high fives. Nigga, I be spiked out, I can trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I'm most definitely from.
Good morning, New York City. Yeah, just finished that documentary about Paul Robeson. I'll never forget up here at WBAI meeting his son and finding out the story about how he sung Kevin Barry, Paul Robeson. It was a great story and one of those chance meetings up here at WBAI. And I said, yes, good morning. And thank God for Jewish holidays, because Malachi McCord and Corey Kilgannon are here today. And they didn't talk about traffic anywhere. I want more Jewish holidays on Wednesday.
Absolutely.
So you can get down the West Side Highway and over to Brooklyn Bridge.
And a parking spot.
And a holy Jesus.
And I'm no longer an atheist.
It's win-win. I think we should all convert and come up with new holiday, new Jewish holidays anyway.
Perhaps more Jewish holidays, yes.
And if this is fall, WBAI listeners, you know the drill. It's fundraising season. You might think it's fall season, but it's fundraising season. And we got the whole crew here today. Malachi McCourt. Can I say anything else but his name? And Corey Kilgannon from the New York Times, and we'll be using some of his contacts and stories throughout the show to show why you should be giving in to the station. So it's going to be a mix of guests here today and fundraising. And on today's show, we're going to have the son of Gene Tunney, famous heavyweight boxer, as people from County Mayo. And Malachi, why are we having on Jay Tunney? You said he's got a book out, or
he wrote a book about his father and his father's connection with George Bernard Shaw, another Mick, and so Gene Tunney was a longshoreman, and then he got into boxing. And he had a little bit of a bout with a fellow named Jack Dempsey. Mm-hmm. And there was, and the how he won the heavyweight championship was, there was a long count.
Right, the infamous
because
long count.
Dempsey did not go back to his corner until within the 10-second count. So he didn't start counting. And then Tunney got 4 more seconds, which allowed him to recover and to defeat Dempsey. So that was that famous famous bout. But anyway, Gene Tunney was a great reader, a self-taught man, and he married well, and there we are.
Well, that won't be a book we're using as a premium, but we have a guest in the studio, Eamon Lynch, whose second book of a trilogy about the Irish, not far from here in downtown Brooklyn. It's called Exile on Bridge Street. That's published by Three Rooms Press, great friends of WBAI, Kate and Pete. We'll be talking to Eamon in a little while about the book, and that book will be for $75. But also we'll be using Angela's Ashes, the 20th anniversary since Angela's Ashes came out, and that'll be $100 at 516 516- 620-3602. We'll be giving out that number quite a lot. You can help the station and get the book. But first, I was telling Malachi, I wanted to comment on some of the events that went on this week with the future President Trump, who is now on our side because he's attacking Republicans, and it doesn't get any better than President Trump attacking them. And I love that President Trump now says the shackles are off. And about his statement, Malachi, I wanted to talk about, they were talking about this Billy Bush, who doesn't fall far from the tree with Donald Trump, talking about how to grope women and this locker room where they weren't in a locker room. But that Billy Bush, this was a youthful indiscretion at the age of 33. Now, I was in the American Army at 19, 18. I was shooting M60s, M60. If I got in trouble and was court-martialed, I could not use as a defense that I was youthful and immature. You were a man at the time. You're in the Army. You're going to be charged. And that could not be used as a defense. But yet, every time something happens, if you remember when it came out about George Bush's DWI up in Vermont and New Hampshire, he was in his 40s or 50s, and they said, well, that was a youth. That's when he was drinking back in his days of youth. 40s and 50s. Trump was 59 when he made these comments. I mean,
well, you have to be fair, John.
Yes, and I know you will be.
Yeah, you have to be fair. Now, Mr. Trump was only 59. Now, you reach the age of reason at 65. That's when they give you Social Security.
Oh, that's
when
how it works.
They realize you have matured and that you can spend all that money sensibly. And so, therefore, Mr. Trump was not of the age of reason at 59. And also, he was also taking lessons in the English language. And he was learning to speak, and he was doing fairly well. So, I mean, the man was just trying out the language, for heaven's sake. And he was then and is now a very good Christian. And and the people say he was married. Well, he was actually involved with the Mormons at that time, and that's why he has three wives. I mean, people have to make allowances for this, for his incursion. He was trying out various Christian practices and principles and so on. And he was trying out
three wives, five kids,
And also that he was helping American business. He was importing nice women who were working and everything else. And of course, he didn't grope them. He just went to bed with them. You know, there was no groping.
But what do you think about his son, Eric Trump, describing why these statements were issued? He said that his father, and this is how rich people talk, he's an alpha male. And this is how alpha males talk. Well, normally I would call him an arrogant prick.
Yeah.
But if you're rich, and his son was defending him, he said, no, this is how alpha males speak.
Oh, he's from a male?
Alpha male? No.
County male?
Alpha male. Yeah.
Oh, alpha male. Oh, I see.
Yes.
Of course, I know that alpha limericks wouldn't talk like that. That's how they speak, is it?
That's what he said, you know.
Where is his birthday? When is his birthday?
I couldn't tell you, nor
is,
do
is,
I.
Is that a birth sign or something, or a hormonal
thing? I know,
thing?
But I love the way people try to explain it away. His son, who goes to Africa to hunt exotic animals and take pictures with them about what a great hunter he is as he's shooting zebras and
lions
and, you know, like, yeah. what a brave man he is, you know, heading over to Africa.
Well, certainly he is. He's a member of the NRA, is he not?
Yeah. Well, listen, if you're going to be a son of Donald, you have to be a brave man, I think.
Speaking of,
the wives would have to be brave.
I was wondering about, do you think or do you know if Adolf Hitler was a member of the NRA? Because I know that at the end, when he decided that they must have given him a permit of some sort, because he was he shot himself. So I imagine that. Can you imagine if these gun control idiots were in power, that Hitler would not have had a gun?
So that's something to think about.
Yeah,
you really think deep about these things. That's why I'm so glad.
You have to keep up. You have to keep up with the current affairs. I mean, Hitler shot himself. Thanks be to Jesus.
All right, Malky, before we start giving the heavy pitch here about WBAI and our fundraiser, we have with us on the line Brenda Costello, who's with the Irish American Writers and Artists Group, an organization that Malachy McCourt helped found. Is going to be honored on Monday by the organization, and he's getting the Eugene O'Neill Award. I was going to say Eugene Debs, but the same thing. Eugene O'Neill Award. And Brendan, how can people, I mean, they're listening to Malachy now, but how can they see the man himself, get pictures taken with them, and where and how, what is happening on Monday?
Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Brendan.
Hello. Yes, it's all been leading up to this. On Monday, we've got the annual presentation of the Eugene O'Neill Lifetime Achievement Award, which is not an achievement in behaving or living life like Eugene O'Neill, fortunately, because otherwise that would be kind of a miserable thing, I suppose. But it's for outstanding achievement and contribution to the body of work that we consider, the work of Irish American writers and artists. And this year we're honoring Mr. McCourt, as you know, and that is going to be on Monday from 6 to 9 at Rosie O'Grady's, the upstairs, the Manhattan room of Rosie O'Grady's, which is at 800 7th Avenue. And for folks who are interested, you can purchase a ticket by going through our website, which is i-am-wa.org, or they can also go directly to, I'm just going to pull up the name of the site here, it is iawaoneilaward.eventbrite.com. I'll spell that.
Well, you know what, Brenda, the best way is just go to Google, type in Irish American Writers and Artists, and that's the first thing that comes up, the first link, and you can get it through the website. And when you buy a ticket, it includes membership within the organization, which every month has two salons where you can try out poetry, your writings, and just be part of an Irish American community. And you don't have to be Irish American, and test out your material in front of people and get great feedback. So I mean, it's just great all around.
The salons, and we were speaking about this last time I was on, but the salons are really a really amazing thing to see, because it's something that, again, something that was a brainchild really of Malachy, of yours, and the diversity of what people produce. It's not all exclusively what we might normally associate with Irish American storytelling, and I mean, there are some sort of like traditional topics that people cover, certainly, a lot of stuff about the immigration experience, or just about what it means to be Irish or whatever, but it's definitely not exclusively that. It's also not, you're right, it's not exclusively, you don't have to be Irish to be a member, you don't have to be Irish to be a presenter. And even if you don't present, it's a wonderful convivial evening, and you see a wide range of people's work, people doing, reading their, fiction or nonfiction or poetry. Some people get up and do monologues, or they do scenes from plays that they're working on, or just work that they're developing.
Like John McDonough's play, Captivist.
Indeed, Captivist had a
which he's done now.
I mean, trying out new. And Brendan, will there be any special guests? Because a lot of Malachy's friends will be coming on Monday. Who might be dropping by?
Well, I can't say 100%. We're still waiting on hearing from a couple of let's just say Hollywood types, and let's just say I don't know if it counts as Hollywood if they're on Netflix, but there will be some there are going to be some well-known people who are going to be on stage and presenting. There's also going to be a lot of people just in the audience who do tend to show up for these things, and I think will especially be up for coming out to see Malachy. We're expecting Gail Brewer from the city government to read a proclamation. I hope I'm not spoiling anything for you by saying that. I don't know what the proclamation is going to say. So, you know, he may not want to be there for that. We may have to duck you out the side entrance. We are hoping to have a couple of people who are very well known. And in addition, Kieran and Charlotte from the Irish Rep, I believe, are going to be who are previous recipients of this award are going to be there, I believe. Again, it's tricky because there are a lot of people with different schedules who may or may not show up. I mean, in the past, also, we've had surprise guests a few years ago, actually, when we were honoring Pete Hamill. The governor showed up completely sort of unannounced, which was kind of a strange thing. So I'm not sure which politicians might be showing up for you or might be showing up to try to arrest you, Balaki, but somebody will be there. I'm sure there'll definitely be surprises for us all, but it's going to definitely be a wonderful night and definitely a great cause to support, a great individual to honor, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Now, as you mentioned, the purchase of a ticket also enrolls you in the organization, which it's sort of an annual dues-based thing, but it's in addition to the salons, there are a lot of other benefits. There are different events that we do from time to time, or we partner with other organizations and have other different types of things going on. We do a scholarship at the high school that's named after your brother Frank in Upper West Side, where we give an annual award to a graduating senior with a lot of literary promise, and that's been an interesting thing that we've been involved with. And as I think I mentioned last time, you know, we do work with other charity organizations as well. So, you know, I wouldn't say self promotion, but let's just say we're in addition to doing art material stuff, we are also making a difference socially and you know, in a positive way.
Well, the salons also, Brandon, as we might mention, are absolutely free. They don't cost you anything to come and show your work. And also, we have done work with libraries. We did some work with raising funds for Haiti quite a little while ago, and wherever there is a disaster and disease and despair, there we are.
Sounds like a book to me. Well, Brendan, thanks for coming on. If people want tickets, they can go to Irish American Writers and Artists, just Google it, and get a ticket for Monday night. You can see the one and only Malachy McCourt accepting all the praise that it's well-deserved.
And thank you very much, Brendan. That's Brendan Costello. He's
my pleasure. Thank you guys very much, and have a great day. See you on Monday.
Okay, then, Brendan.
All right.
Well, back to WBAI, Malachy, and this is the fall offensive here, and we're raising money for WBAI, and one of the books that we used originally 20 years ago as a premium here, and I never forget you and Frank coming up and pitching this new book called Angela's Ashes,
yes.
And it's now the 20th anniversary, and for $100, if you call 516-620-3602, you can get the book signed by Malachy, and Malachy's going to read a couple of verses or paragraphs from the book. And later on, we're going to have Eamon Lynch, who also has a book out called Exile on Bridge Street, the second of a trilogy, put out by Three Rooms Press. And we'll be talking to him in a little while and pushing that book for $75. But right now, I hope Eamon doesn't mind. But we're going to go with Angela's Ashes first. And Malachy, what did you think when Frank first wrote this? Did you think it was going to become the phenomenon it did? Or you just said, well, Frank, this is just about our life. Who's going to buy a book about, like you said, some of the people that you had sent it to? The publisher said, who wants to read about poor people in Limerick coming to New York?
About an obscure town, an obscure school teacher writing about an obscure town about poverty. Do you think anybody will buy a book like that? Will you bugger off, for God's sake? So anyway, I had for years been urging my brother Frank McCourt to write the story of our family. Not because our family was particularly interesting, because All family stories have large similarities, as Eamon Lynch does point out, and he's a very good writer, by the way. He's a great storyteller, and many times he's very lyrical, too. A good writer, an accomplished writer, a wordsmith. But Frank, Jimmy Breslin, a couple of things that Frank had written over the years. He wrote a few articles in the Village Voice. And I had been onto him to write about the family. And I said, because if you don't, and I threatened him, if you don't, I will. And I guarantee you, I will screw it up so badly that people will say, who gives a fiddler's fart about this, about them, and this rotten book and so forth. So you better write it. Because Breslin, Jimmy Breslin said Frank was just a great, the best of all the writers at the hangout that we all used to go to, the literary bar, the Lion's Head. So I was on him. And then I have a group of people, we meet every first Friday of the month for a lunch. And Mary Breasted, who was an accomplished novelist herself, was there one day, and she said to Frank after he retired, what are you doing now? He said, well, I'm writing this kind of an autobiographical thing, he said. She said, could I see it? So Frank said yes, and he sent her some pages, and she took it to an agent. He just, as he handed it back, contemptuous, nobody cares about this Irish stuff anymore. It's passé and all of that. Yeah. She said, can I give it to another agent? Oh, well, give it to wherever you like, because we'll never hear of it again. So I imagine that, people said, you have to eat your words at times, Mark Twain. And so this guy is making a feast of words because he had to eat them, because this book has sold over 12 million copies. Anyway, when Frank got published by Scribner's, and he sent it to me, and I was impressed, but I knew what he could do. And I called him and said, you will win the Pulitzer Prize. Jimmy Breslin said, you will win the Pulitzer Prize. And various other people said, you will win the Pulitzer Prize. And the committee of the Pulitzer Prize Award said, you have the Pulitzer Prize. And that's what happened with the book.
But wasn't it serialized in the New York Magazine or the New Yorker?
It was in New Yorker, yeah.
And so, how did that come about? I mean, why? Because they don't just take anything to put into the magazine.
Well, they have people on the lookout all the time for works that would appeal to their readers. And, of course, the criteria is it has to be good writing, and that's very, very simple. I'm not sure we would allow Frank into the Irish writers and at all, but we did. He eventually did join. No, he did not. No, we were. We hadn't formed yet.
Right.
We hadn't formed, but he would have. But he's good friends with. He was good friends with everybody. So that's the way it is. So this premium now is Angela's Ashes, and if you call in, I will sign a book, and we will send it to you. I'm sorry that Frank is not here to sign it himself. I have been trying to get in touch with him, but apparently he's on a higher plane and he's incommunicado at the moment. And I don't know what he is doing, but I know he's not in a place where he can light his pipe with his finger. But he would be, I think, a great piece. And so his legacy is terrific. I mean, so many. He was one thing that he always wanted to be remembered as a teacher. That was his love. He was a guy, I think he was the only high school teacher in New York that did not have a high school diploma, because we both left school at a very early age. He was 13 when he left, and I was 13 a year later when I left. But we were both omnivorous readers. We read everything that we could get our hands on. And there was a matter of pilfering books as well from various places wherever we could get our hands on them. And then the Carnegie Library opened up, And, it was, if somebody said to me, and although we were starving, we needed food, if somebody said to me, would you like a dinner or a book, I would choose the book, because the love of reading, it was it was so inspiring. The words on the very feel of a book, the look of a book, the texture of a book. And when you go to bed, and my dream was that one day I would be able to lie in a bed all by myself with sheets, clean sheets, with a pillow or two. And can you imagine by your bed electric light, a light that you could switch on and off with your fingers, and not a candle, not a paraffin oil lamp that you had to put out because you were, as they said in Ireland, wasting oil or wasting the candle. And you're ruining, oh, that was the other thing they always were after us. You're ruining your eyes with that reading. That's what the older, some of the older, not my mother, I must say, but other people. Frank and I used to stand, Larry Kirwan has gone off to Ireland. He's the president of the Irish Writers, taking a bunch of people on tour, and he's going to Limerick next week. And he was asking me what he should see, and I told him go to the Frank McCourt Museum. And I told him then the lane we lived in, this fetid slum that would make the Casbah look like luxurious living. And I said, there is a light pole put up by the public electricity company that was at the end. Now, the slum houses are gone. Frank said that Limerick is gone to hell. You cannot find a decent slum there anymore. But at the head of where the lane was, there is a electric light pole. And Frank and myself used to stand under that light reading on freezing cold nights. Never felt a thing when you had a good book. It was amazing that here we were out in the night and just standing there on cold winter's night trying to get read. And that was it. And so it's how do you learn to write? You read, and that's what's happening. Now the folks in charge of our various institutions and governments and so forth, they do not want anybody to be able to read, and they don't want anybody to be able to write. They want people, like Trump once, he said, "I love the uneducated." Because the uneducated follow him, and the uneducated followed Hitler the same way. And Hitler said, all great revolutionary events were not inspired by the written word, they were inspired by the spoken word. And he proved that with his Nuremberg speeches and so on. As Trump would be nowhere if it weren't for television. And he's able to repeat absolute rubbish time and time again. He says the same thing over and over. Just shout threats. Just shout imprecations. Just speak lies, but say them loudly and emphatically, and you get people on your side. And that's the way. So anyway, that we were able to get our education through reading, and oddly enough, reading stuff like P.G. Woodhouse and Dickens.
Now, you're going to read a little piece from Andrew's Ashes, yep. And we'll give you the numbers, 516-620-3602 for $100. Mally, who's the picture on the front of the book is a small child that's barefoot. Who is that?
Nobody knows.
So who picked the picture?
The publisher picked it.
And they just picked it, not even Frank or you or anybody.
No,
they just picked...
I don't know who that kid is. But he looks like he's a chubby.
A little street urchin.
Yeah, he's a chubby little fella with a little cap on him and living outside. It looks like he's standing on a boarded up window, it is actually. Hmm. So there it is. Pulitzer Prize.
And what part are you going to read here now?
I just read the opening now. And
that's a famous opening line. I heard it on RTE one day.
Yes.
And they were saying these lines will live in infamy, to the first lines of Angela Sanchez. Right.
Yes, indeed. It is, here we are. My father and mother should have stayed in New York, where they met and married, and where I was born. Instead, they returned to Ireland when I was 4, Malachy 3, the twins Oliver and Eugene barely 1, and my sister Margaret dead and gone. When I look back on my childhood, I wonder how I survived it all. It was, of course, a miserable childhood. The happy childhood is hardly worth your while. Worse than the ordinary miserable childhood is the miserable Irish childhood. And worse yet is the miserable Irish Catholic childhood. People everywhere brag and whimper about the woes of their early years, but nothing can compare with the Irish version. The poverty, the shiftless, loquacious, alcoholic father, the pious, defeated mother, moaning by the fire, pompous priests, bullying schoolmasters, the English, and the terrible things they did to us for 800 long years. Above all, we were wet. Out in the Atlantic, great sheets of rain gathered to drift slowly up the River Shannon and settle forever in Limerick. The rain dampened the city from the Feast of the Circumcision to New Year's Eve. It created a cacophony of hacking coughs, bronchial rattles, asthmatic wheezes, consumptive croaks. It turned noses into fountains, lungs into bacterial sponges. It provoked cures galore to ease the catarrh. You boiled onions in milk, blackened with pepper. For the congested passages, you made a paste of boiled flour and nettles, wrapped it in a rag, and dropped it sizzling on the chest. From October to April, the walls of Limerick glistened with the damp. Clothes never dried, tweed and woolen coats housed living things, sometimes sprouted mysterious vegetations. In pubs, steam arose from damp bodies, and the garments to be inhaled with cigarette and pipe smoke, laced with the stale fumes of spilled stout and whiskey, and tinged with the odour of piss, wafting in from the outdoor jakes, where many a man puked up his week's wages. The rain drove us into the church, our refuge, our strength, our only dry place. At Mass, Benediction, Novenas, we huddled in great damp clumps, dozing through priestly drones, while steam arose again from our clothes to mingle with the sweetness of incense, flowers, and candles. Limerick gained a reputation for piety, but we knew it was only the rain.
Ooh, that's a lot in a couple of paragraphs. you know why. When you hear, Corey, listen, you write for a living. When you hear something like that, talk about capturing the moment.
That's a beautiful opening. Yeah.
It's just, listen, we're at WBAI.
Give the number, right?
The number is 516-620-3602. For $100, you can get the 20th anniversary edition that has just come out of Angela's Ashes. And you just heard there a reading by Malachy of the book and about his growing up in that cold and damp Limerick. I know when I asked my mother, would she ever go back to Donegal? And the one reason she said she would never go back was the cold.
Yeah.
She said the cold never left her, and that's why she liked New York. It was warm. But the dampness and the cold that he was describing, that just never left.
Well,
yeah, you had to be around that turf fire when you went into anyone's house.
And you only got the ABCs on your shins because the front of you was to the fire. And your arse was just frozen, you know, because all the drafts of windows half broken and doors that were not fully closed, and a damp house with the with the rain, the water actually dripping slowly down, you know, coming in from, you didn't know where it came from. And the thing about Irish rain is, now, it's not like rain here. The rain here is fully capitalistic. You're fully aware of its existence. It comes down in torrents and it absolutely soaks you, and then it goes away, but then you have the means and the wherewithal to get into your habitation where it's usually warmed by some kind of heating, which we didn't have, and you got off your clothes and you changed them and you dried whatever you were wearing. We had no change of clothes. There was no such thing. If we wanted to get warm again, you had to strip and try and put the clothing, your bits of rags, in front of a fire, and then you climbed into bed. Now, we didn't have blankets. We had old discarded coats and kind of ancient pieces of wool and stuff that we huddled under.
And burlap bags too, probably, maybe from nothing. Well, that'd be more farming.
We didn't have food, so therefore the life was just. And then you, but the rain, you see, the thing about the rain, it was insidious as Irish talk, because it was very indirect. You know, Irish people never get a direct insult from anybody. It was like when somebody said, "Oh, look at my daughters, aren't they beautiful?" And the guy says, next to her says, "Ah, if them girls were hanged for their beauty, they would die completely innocent." Now, he didn't say they were ugly. He said, you know.
That's what Trump would do.
Trump would never
have the wit to say something like that.
So Irish rain is very indirect. You don't know that you're thoroughly and totally soaked until you come in and you realize you've had it for the day. Consequently, consumption, rheumatism and Catholicism and all the other diseases of Ireland were just infected us. And so with the result that my brothers died, my two brothers, my sister died, 11 of my classmates died. We were just, it was, but of course, in Ireland, which is very nice, the nice thing about it is they mourn marriages and celebrate death, because they always say that, he's gone to a better place. And of course, when God kills children, you know, which, because God does everything, when he kills children, they say things like, "God needed another angel." Well, go and get your own bloody angels. We they're my brothers. And then, of course, you have these little pictures of. Do you ever see these paintings of angels flying around, little wings, totally naked? And nobody ever worries about them defecating and peeing on us.
That doesn't
They're flying
happen.
Around up there.
Well, if you want to get the book, Angel's Ashes, for $100, 516-620-3602. And we also, Malachi, have another premium. And I really believe if you live in New York, you cannot publish a book and not have a quote from you. I mean, this is a book that we're using that's been written by Eamon Lynch. It's called Exiled on Bridge Street. It's the second of a trilogy. And a quote, "A grand read, leaving any reader fully sated. Don't leave the store without this book." You're almost like Abby Hoffman. Steal this book.
Yes.
Now, that's not going to help Eamon if you're referring to Abby Hoffman. You said, "Don't leave the store without the book." But how often do you get, I mean, you have a lot of quotes on a lot of book jackets when you go around Barnes & Noble. I mean, it just, how do people approach you, and how does that happen?
With a $100 bill, of course.
Well, then he would be a very wealthy man.
That I would. Now, actually, they're not a lot. There are, I love reading, and Eamon Lynch happens to be a very good writer, and when I read his work, I said, "That's for me." And it's very hard. You can, as they say, you can't put down the book either metaphorically or literally. And Eamon Lynch is a wonderful writer, and he writes about something that's very dear to me, because it's I was a dock worker, and B, I was still a native of Brooklyn, and here I am working in Brooklyn. So, Eamon, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor for me, too, because in my family, who came from Brooklyn too, and Long Island as well. As a kid, growing up, I was handed books by the McCourts all over the place, thrown at me, you know, basically, you know. When you just read from Angela's Ashes, and the funny thing was is when I was, I don't know how old I was, when did it come out, 96?
96
is when it came out, so I was like 25 or so. And I wasn't into reading, I was into girls, of course.
Yeah.
And I was into girls and whiskey, that's what I was doing. So my grandfather said, you got to read this book, and I was like, oh, geez, you know, Tim Pat Coogan, you know, I read all the sad stories about Ireland. But then when I read this book, I read that first sentence that you just read.
Yeah.
And I am not kidding when I tell you, I didn't put it down. I read the entire book, rolling around in bed, holding it over my head, laying on my stomach, reading it. I could not put it down. I just could not put it down. And I've read it like 3 times since then.
Well, that's the thing about you two, Em, and you are a lot of writers are not very generous toward other writers. And you are a very generous man. And you have granted your talents to a lot of people. And here we have, how did you get on to your own work regarding your own life? And what did you think this is an interesting story? In the sense of like your own history, I should say, You're very aware. You're historically aware. You let us all live it with you. That's the great thing about your writing.
Thank you. The thing that got me started writing, I think, was hearing stories myself about New York. When I was 5 years old, my parents got divorced and we moved to Florida. So I lived there for many years, but living with my grandparents and my mother and everything, I heard stories about New York City, stretching all the way back to New York. I was stretching all the way back to Ireland. My great grandparents and grandparents essentially lived in the same neighborhoods that they were dumped in, you know, after the Great Hunger, the famine in the 1840s in Brooklyn. It was a place called Irishtown. It's no longer called that anymore. You can't find that on a map, but they lived there. My grandmother was born.
Where was Irishtown?
Between what we call Vinegar Hill, between Navy Yard and the bridges.
Right.
Right on the water there.
Yeah.
It was a place where thousands of famine Irish, you know, were dumped off on the waterfront there with no shoes and starving, looking for work. And there was longshoreman work to be had even in the 1840s. It was not the busiest port in the world back then. London still was, but it was still a very busy port, New York City. Ferries everywhere, steam, you know, not so many steamships, but clippers and just, you know, things needed to be unloaded and, you know, the labor work needed to be done. And, you know, all the way into the 1950s, that's what you were doing. You've told me stories about the bosses making you cover yourself with silk so you can steal it under your clothes.
They would make me wrap the silk clothing, silk fabric around my waist and then pull up my trousers over it, and I'd look like this big fat guy because I had yards and yards and yards of silk stuff that they made the suits out of, all wrapped around me. Because if you didn't steal it, they looked upon you as an informer.
Exactly. So that's really where I got the idea to look into these stories. It took me a few years to get my brain together. And I think as an Irish writer, you can't really start writing until you really get drunk at least 1,000 times. So I had a few years to go.
Yeah.
And a lot of books to read. So here I am now putting them out, though. Every 2 years we're putting out a book. Light of the Didikoi came out 2014. Exile on Bridge Street now coming out in 2016. But the story essentially comes from the stories that my grandparents told me about New York City and Brooklyn. And, you know, my great-grandfather in 1906 opened up a saloon in Manhattan on a corner of Barrow and Hudson. It's still there today. It was called Lynch's Tavern back then. It was sold in the 70s.
Near the White Horse?
Near the White Horse, I'm not sure.
You know, the White Horse was 11th.
I was thinking the Lion's Head, yeah.
Yeah.
But the White Horse, yeah.
Yeah. That's still there, isn't it? The
White Horse? And now it's called Barrow's Pub, I think.
Oh, really?
On the corner of Hudson and Barrow.
Yeah, right.
Where my grandparents' saloon used to be, but I never had a chance to.
Was that Lynch's saloon?
It used to be Lynch's Tavern, yeah.
Would you say The way that Tammany got its prestige, whatever, was because, first of all, Tammany was an ancient English institution, and it's pejoratively named after an Indian chief, St. Tammany. Yeah. But the upper classes dominated, and there were no Irish near apply in that place. But they came and busted down the doors, literally busted down the doors of Tammany, and went in, invaded, and took over. And that's how the Democrats' party started and all that. And they said corrupt, as they always were Tammany. Well, Tammany was. They gave coal and heat and food to the poor. They literally did. Mm. They had no greater vision for anything in the future. But Tammany became more powerful because they looked, every vote counted, as Tip O'Neill said, you know, all politics is local. And so Tammany. So anyway, but where their base of power was, it was in the saloons owned by Irish saloon keepers. And they were people who did not drink themselves, no matter what anybody said. Tammany leaders did two things they didn't do. They didn't make speeches and they didn't drink, no matter what anybody says.
Teetotalers.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And teetotalers, silent men, mm-hmm. You know. But anyway, would you know if your grandfather was involved in politics?
My great-grandfather was heavily involved in passing the hat around to all the longshoremen in the saloon, sending it back for, you know, what they would call, you know, Irish freedom.
Yeah.
It wasn't called rebellion or rebels or anything like that. It was called freedom.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what on Hudson Street alone, there was something like 100 bars.
Yeah.
Irish saloons at the time. And his was just one of them. And the Tammany guys would come in and, you know, shake hands with my great-grandfather, who was 6'4" and had worked as a sand hog a bunch of years before, in the 1890s, before we got to the saloon. And, you know, they would come up and pick up all the change that the longshoreman gave. You know, every longshoreman give 10, 20 cents a day. You know, that adds up over a month, and then they'd send it back to Ireland. You know, that was not something that my grandfather, who was very religious, he didn't really ever want to talk to me about that, but my father would elbow me in the side and say, oh, it was true. It was definitely true. They supported the IRA. Say it. Believe it. It happened. You know, IRA is like, they call it a terrorist organization.
They do.
So terrible. It's so terrible. Yeah. But you know what? Back before it was called the terrorist organization, my family was helping Irish freedom.
I always wonder about, here a country invades another country. Like the French invading Algiers, the people resist, and because they resist, they are terrorists. Right? And here, I mean, the Brits were here, and George Washington booted them. They were, of course, King George and that crowd were all conservatives, as was Benedict Arnold and so forth. But and people are taught about bringing back conservatives. So you're a traitor to democracy if you're a conservative, because that's what we kicked out. But when people try and kick out the invader or the oppressor, they're called terrorists. That's so very, very strange. I mean, the reason why bin Laden did what he did was because America was putting troops in their sacred territory in Mecca and Medina. And it would be like if the Russians invaded the Vatican, you know. But anyway, the latest book is Exile on Bridge Street. It's written by Eamon Lynch and Three Rooms Press. Yeah, is one of our premiums today, and our number is what, 516-620-3602. My eyesight is going, so I have to read this on the wall. And that's the pledge line. So now, very slowly, repeat after me. 516. How about that? 516. The next number is 620. And the next number, 620. Say that. 516-620. Got it? Good. Very good. And the next number, there's three little digits here. 3602. And that, my dear friends, is the number you call. Now you can give me the book and Exile on Bridge Street. written by Eamon Lynch for A Pledge, A Pledge. Now, pledges are not paid. Pledges are honored, okay? And we only have honorable people listening to our radio station. So you will honor your pledge of $75, and we will send you Exile on Bridge Street. And you don't have to be a Brooklynite to read any of Eamon Lynch's books, because we have Light of the Didikoi, number one, and number two, Exile on Bridge Street. Now, that's easy enough to remember, Exile on Bridge Street by Eamon Lynch. And the number, again, is 516-620-3602. If you, and you know what? You don't have to be a reader. All you have to do is send in $75. We will send you Exile on Bridge Street, and you can prop yourself up and read to your children. Read to yourself and have a lot of fun with that.
And Eamon, how did you go about getting that great quote from Malachi? Was it you or was it Pete? And Kate, or how did that come about?
No, I had been stalking Malachi for years. you know, like him, I grew up amongst women, and I read his book Among Swimming years and years ago. I thought it was extremely witty and very funny. A little bit more coarse than Frank's books, but I enjoy that part of it as well. But yeah, I gave him a call. Somehow I got his phone number, and I gave him a call, left him a message, and he called me back when I was at a restaurant. And soon enough, we met and hung around and had some tea together and spoke. And I went to some salons, and yeah, he lucky enough, he gave me a blurb for the book.
And we had a great reading of it one evening on Barrow Street.
On Barrow Street.
It was the Barrow Street Theater, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. It was just exactly where the family saloon was about 10 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. And there we are. Mm-hmm. So let me see. Exile on Bridge Street. And the number is 516-620-3602. And that's your pledge number.
And you can get that for $75. And be very explicit when you call up and they answer the phone. You have to say Exile on Bridge Street, $75. That'll go that. Also, you can get Angelus Ashes. It's the 20th anniversary for $100. So when you call up, or you can donate anything. You get $5, $25, anything to help the show, to keep the crew that we have here with Corey Kilgannon's waiting in the wings. He's got two guests that he's written stories about that'll be coming on in the second hour. And the Wednesday 2 hours has been just God sent to me, because I do a show on Saturday, and, you know, I am cornered in because it's ethnic show. It's Irish Radio Free Erin. But on Wednesdays, the whole world opens up to me, and the whole world to me is New York City. And I have to tell you,
and Brooklyn.
And also Brooklyn, yes. Yeah. And I have to say, having Corey Kilgannon here, when he sends out an email to get a guest on, we get a return. If it was me sending it out, you know, John McDonough, Joe Blow, well, what's the station, what's that? They don't seem to ask the same questions when Corey sends it out. And the guests that Corey has gotten over, we've almost been doing this 2 years, have been phenomenal. I mean, the guests, you just can't believe who we've lined up.
Tony Bargains.
Well, yeah, now Tony, he's been banned for a little while. Tony from the Bronx, he got a little too Bronx on us.
Racy.
Yes.
Joe the handball player.
Yes. I was thinking more along Jim Dwyer and some of the other
Dan
columnists.
Barry.
Yeah. But no, we do. I mean, your characters, your New York character studies, and having them on every week and hearing their stories, and it's a great New York 2 hours here at WBAI. If you want to keep that going, because there are changes coming to WBAI already. About 20 or 30% of the shows have been changed around, dropped, shuffled around. You know, it could happen because BAI has to try something. We have to come up with a new business model, because just pitching almost all year long is just not doing it. And this is it going into the end of the year, and we need you to donate at 516-620-3602.
And if we, as our program here on Wednesdays, we're going to be rated on how listenership and on people's interest in the show, and that is manifested by the amount of money that you pledge to send in our name. Because if you don't subscribe, the management of WBAI is going to say, well, nobody is listening to these crowd of people on Wednesday morning, so let's find out what we can put on there. And they will find a show about how to, if you drink lemonade, how good it is for your kidneys or something like that, you know, something that would be useful to people, or how to cut an ingrown toenail. You never know what might replace us. But we will definitely be replaced. I mean, that's a guarantee, if we are not successful. And that's the way it is. And success depends on you sending in, subscribing to WBAI. You can call it donating. I call it subscribing. Donate is you give and you don't get anything in return. You subscribe and you get us every Wednesday from 10 a.m. to noon. That is, you subscribe and there is a return. If you don't like us, you won't send. If you like us, you will. And there you are. Now, you can subscribe to WBAI, and you will get Exile on Bridge Street if you subscribe, say, $75. You will get Angela's Ashes if you subscribe $100. You will get both if you subscribe $175, and $25 just for the hell of it. And that makes $200. And that's all there is to it. Now, that's very simple. And so please do that. It is, if you do want us on
Now, you know what happens on that? And I just say, you have to be very specific with these people, because we had, say we're doing Exile on Bridge Street, and a person calls up and they go, I want to get Exile on Bridge Street, but I want to make it $100. And they say, no, we can't do it. It's for $75. And it reminds me of the scene with Jack Nicholson when he went into the diner, and he said to the waitress, I want a bacon, lettuce, and tomato. She says, well, we don't do that. And he says, all right, do you do bread? Yes. Do you do bacon? Do you do lettuce? Well, just bring me all of that, and I'll just put it on the sandwich. But they were so stickler that, you know, well, no, sorry, you can't do it. You can do it $75 for the book and $25 as a separate pledge.
Oh, yeah.
But they have their headphones on, and they are just looking. No, you cannot do that. This book is down for $75.
And that's that.
And that's that. And it just goes back to Jack Nicholson trying to order a BLT at a diner and trying to get around it. But listen, that's the way it is, because we used to have people come up, listeners, but then a lot of times they wouldn't show up, you know, because they weren't being paid. And, you know, you would have times the phones could be ringing off the hook, and there was no one here to take the pledge. At least now there's a call center. Eventually someone will pick up. And for $75, you can call at 516-620-3602. Or I don't know if I should say 02, because I get the ghost.
Zero.
No, but I get the ghost of Monroe calling in and complaining about it's not zero, or it's not O, or that's an alphabet. And, you know, oh, my God, just call the number, please. I don't want to get into the semantics of that. Because at 11 o'clock here at WBAI, we're going to play a little music. We're going to come back, and Mally's going to interview the son of Gene Tunney, who in his day was probably one of the most famous people in the world. There's people from County Mayo. They were famine Irish that came over, and he became a heavyweight boxer. Actually, during the time frame almost that you're writing about in Exile and Bridge Street.
And also, he lived very close to where Eamon Lynch's ancestor saloon was, down in the village, because Gene Tunney was a guy from the village.
Right.
And he worked on the docks. That's where he worked on on the New York docks.
All right, so I'm going to give the pledge number one more time. You get either book. We're going to play a little music. We come back. We're going to have Jay Tunney on and talk about his connection with George Bernard Shaw.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yep.
You'd never think the heavyweight champion.
Yep, right.
And what was, you said there was a correspondence?
There was correspondence and meetings. They spent, he had both of them, both people spent their holidays with each other on an island in off Italy, which I can't remember. We'll find out from
Jay. All right, yeah. So a little music. We come back. We're going to speak to the son of Gene Tunney. Welcome back. And in that song, he mentions Gene Tunney, and the reason I know that, because everything is on Wikipedia. And then Wikipedia, they say Richard Thompson happens to mention Gene Tunney. Now, we're in the process of trying to get on his son, Jay Tunney, who's doing a book tour now, and I think he's out in Chicago, Malachi.
He lives there, actually.
Oh, he lives there.
He moved there,
So we're trying to get him on.
Yeah.
And but we're here pitching. You know, there's a lot of seasons here in New York, but there's only one season here at WBAI, and that's the fundraising season. It begins on July 1st, and it ends on December 31st. So you catch it different times. It could be the fall offensive. It could be the spring offensive, the summer offensive.
Highly offensive.
Yeah, yes, that's all the time.
Yeah.
You know, so... But we're fundraising here for WBAI. This is our only shot at fundraising here. For this marathon, we'll be back in November with, as they say, stay tuned for regular programming. So, you know, if you think you're going to put it off and
when are
donate,
we back, John?
Huh?
When are we back?
Well, depending on how the fundraising goes, it could be near Thanksgiving, but we're hoping the first or second week of November that we'll be back and, you know, we'll return to regular programming. But the BAI and Desperate Straits, as usual, but you have to call in at... Maybe we'll just try the 212 one more time, and then. Oh, okay. So that it's just not being picked up on. Hmm. That's all. But Corey, we'll do a little bit of pitching. But who will be the next guest that we've lined up? Is it the baseball guy?
Yeah. Well, I think we should speak to Len Burke first. He's the last. As he calls himself, the last Jewish lox cutter at Zabar's.
Well, that would be very timely because of his.
It's Yom Kippur today.
Yeah.
So it's actually a big day for buying lox and smoked fish at Zabar's. They said they sell 10,000 pounds of smoked fish in this week, in the week leading up to the holiday. So we'll talk to this guy, Len Burke. He's 87 years old. He cuts lox at Zabar's, and he's going to tell us about how he does it. And, you know, Zabar's, you know, is this kind of, you know, mecca for lox buying public. They've been around for about 87 years, and they're at Broadway and 80th Street, as Upper West Siders know, and fans of what they call appetizing food know. And you know, it was cutting fish was always a trade that was long dominated by, you know, old Jewish guys. You know, you think when you used to go to Barney Greengrass or Russ and Daughters on Houston Street. And now, like everything else, it's a different demographic in New York. And now most of the guys behind the counter at Zabar's now are Latino, Puerto Rican guys, and different ethnicity. And Len Burke is the last Jewish guy cutting lox at Zabar's. So we're going to talk to him, and he'll tell us about the busy season behind the lox counter. So we're getting him on the line now. Yeah.
And while we're trying to get him online, you can call 516-620-3602. I'm getting texts from Michael G. texting in from his sick bed saying, come on, have people send in at 516-620-3602. And I think we have him on the line.
We have Len.
Is he allowed to be on the phone today?
Len, are you with us? Len Burke, how are you? Maybe what is he doing? He's making himself a lot. Maybe he's making himself a sandwich over there. I don't know what he's doing.
Are you there, Len?
Yes, I'm here.
Len, are you back? Good.
Yeah, get off the speakerphone and speak directly.
Okay.
Unless you are you cutting as we speak or what, Len? Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I think the only thing he's cutting is cutting us off. Len, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay. So. Thanks for coming on. I was just mentioning to listeners about the lox counter at Zabar's and what an institution it is. And when I did my story that was on the front page of the paper on Sunday, I was lucky enough to speak to you when I was over there doing the reporting at Zabar's, and it was interesting because you had that end position there. That's one of the coveted positions of cutting lox at Zabar's, and I just found it fascinating you talking about how you had a career as an accountant for years, and then after you retired at 65, you somehow, you know, you were into food and you applied to Zabar's to cut lox, and you managed to get behind the counter, and you've been cutting ever since, right?
That's about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about what that's like. I mean, people who, you know, this is, you know, buying lox at Zabar's is one of these things that, you know. Certain, you know, members of the public and people who love their locks. That, I mean, this is like you can go to no better place. So, I mean, what did it take for you to get that job? And do you have your regular following and that type of thing?
Well, first of all, we have to straighten out this locks thing, yeah. Because Zabar's sells more smoked salmon than they do locks. There's a big difference between smoked salmon and locks. Locks is cured; it's very salty. And it's not smoked.
I see. And so
Nova is smoked, and that's what they sell 10,000 pounds of.
I see.
Nova.
So Nova's the.
But people come in and ask for lox, and I always have to make sure that they really want lox before I give them lox, because if I gave them lox and they took it home, and they tasted it, they'd be shocked because it's super salty.
Is that right? Yeah.
And Len, do you do it all there in the store itself? I want to say I come from Queens, and my mother used to work at Rego Smoked Fish in Middle Village, and they used to deliver up to Zabar's and make the delivery there. Is it like Cats where you do everything in-house or you get stuff brought in?
No, most of the stuff is done at smokehouses, mm-hmm. Banner or Acme in Brooklyn, but they smoke the fish to our order, so the smoked fish that we get is very special. You can't get it anywhere else. You can find salmon that's close at maybe Russ and Daughters or Bonnie Greengrass, but Zabar's has the best, and they have the best quality. And if the quality is not there, we don't sell it.
And Len, how much of that comes down to the actual way that the fish is cut? I mean, you always hear about, you know, good, you know.
I'm not hearing you very well.
I'm asking you. I don't know if you can hear me. I'm asking you, how important is the cutting process in the whole thing?
Oh, the cutting process is very, very important. Most people like their smoked salmon cut thin, and there are several reasons for that. First of all, salmon is a very lush fish, and if you put chunks of smoked salmon in your mouth, it becomes very gloppy. Doesn't have a good feel. When the lox is sliced, when the Nova is sliced thin, the mouthfeel is totally different. It's very delicate and pleasurable.
I noticed, Len, that that Corey talked about cutting fish, and you have very subtly changed it to sliced. There is a difference between cutting and slicing.
Right. Smoked salmon or lox is always sliced. It's rarely cut. Whitefish is cut. That's probably the only thing that's really cut in the counter. We have maybe 12 different varieties of fish at the counter, and most of it is sliced.
Has there been a family division in the Zabar family and a split in the family with various premises around town?
Well, there's only one Zabar's.
Yeah.
There are many Zabar's in the city of New York. Zabar's is owned by two brothers, Saul Zabar and Stanley Zabar. And they own Zabar's. But they also have another brother, Eli, who has many food establishments on the
east side.
Upper East Side.
Yeah.
But there's no affiliation to Zabar's.
But nobody goes there.
Well, yeah. Eli is very, very, very expensive.
He's become known for his bread as well, right? Eli Zabar's become known for his bread, right? Bread
baking. That's right, and many other things. We sell Eli's bread at Zabar's.
Yeah.
How many hours do you work, Len?
Well, I work every Thursday and Friday.
Yeah.
On Thursday, I work from 11 to 7, and on Friday, I work from 8 to 5. So that's about 17 hours in 2 days.
And you're on your feet all the time.
I'm on my feet all the time. For an 87-year-old, it's not that easy. But I seem to be able to be handling it pretty well at this point.
Well, I come into Zabar's a lot. This is Malachi McCourt here. And so how will I know you? Will you have a knife in your hand?
Oh, most likely. But I'll also be the oldest guy you can see there.
Not older than me.
Oh, am I not older than you?
Well, I'm 85, so there's two
years.
And
I'm going to be 87 in January.
Well, you weren't around to greet me when I was born? You should have come, Len.
Well, I remember you, Malachi, from way back. I used to hear you on the radio when I was a kid.
Well, thank you, Len. That's lovely. So I'm going to say hello to you. My wife and I go to Zabar's a lot.
Oh, please do, and we'll let you do a tasting.
Oh, that'd be fantastic, and we'll have your special Malachi slice.
Hey,
we'll do that. You'll be one of the other celebrities that come into Zabar's. I meet them all. I slice for them all.
That you do.
It's a lot of fun. It keeps me in the main. Slicing keeps me in the mainstream.
I used to see Eli Wallach there all the time.
Yeah, he passed away recently.
He did, yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, he died.
He was great. He used to come in with his wife.
That's right, yeah, Ann Jackson. Yes, indeed. Yeah, lovely people. Zabar's. I mean, it's like Zabar's is the celebrity. Everybody else came in with disciples and supplicants.
That's true.
And you were the priest, the high priest with the knife.
Well, I love the job. I've done a lot of writing about the job.
Yeah.
I get a big kick out of doing that.
And you won't stop.
And I won't stop until I can't do it anymore.
Yeah, well, take it a day at a time. That's all you can do.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Hey, Len, tell the story before. I don't want to let you go without you telling the story about Woody Allen's mother.
Oh, yeah, yeah. About 5 or 6 years ago, this old woman walked into the store, and she came up to me, and she looked me straight in the eye with a very kind of an angry look on her face, and she said to me, "I don't want salty. Don't give me salty." So at that time, I was still in the mode of taking on the worst customers I could find and trying to give them more than they expected and convert them from being angry and hostile to being sweet and warm. But Woody Allen's mother, she was a tough customer, but she would come in every week and she would say, "I don't want salty." But as the weeks passed and I let her taste the salmon every week, we got to be friends. And we discussed all kinds of things. And then one day she came in with a caregiver. She was getting old. And then maybe 6 months later, the caregiver came in without her. And I said, "Where is she?" And the caregiver said, "She's outside. She's got a case of Alzheimer's, and I don't want to bring her in here." And looking for something to say, I said to her, "Well, at least she still has a good appetite." And lox at that time was about $40 a pound, $38 a pound. And I said, "And she can afford the lox." And the caregiver said to me, "Well, it's not she that can afford the lox. It's her son." And I said, "Her son? Who's her son?" And she said, "Woody Allen is her son." And I had not known that she was Woody Allen's mother, and I was waiting on her for over a year and a half, all this time not knowing who she was. But I got a certain amount of pleasure from knowing that I don't think I would have treated her any better had I known who she was. She's since gone. I wrote a piece about her, and I tried to get it to Woody Allen through the actress Diane Wiest, who was also a customer at Zabar's, and I believe he did read it, and his comment was, "It sounds just like my mother."
She was a salty old lady.
Oh, very salty, right. She was salty, but she didn't like it salty.
What, the word lox, I believe, is from the Norwegian.
Yeah, L-O-C-H-S, yes. I think it was.
Like the lakes in Scotland are called lochs, too.
Right.
Loch Lomond.
Well, those are different lochs.
So, but it's been corrupted to L-O-X, is it? That's the accepted spelling
now. Yeah, the accepted spelling is L-O-X.
Yeah. Do you have to explain to people the difference between smoked salmon and lox?
I do to many.
Yeah.
Because people love to use the word lox, and 95% of them don't really want lox. They want smoked salmon.
Are they what we call gonoffs?
No. We only get classy people at table. Although we do have our tasters that come in just to get a free taste of this and a free taste of that.
But oh, I see. All right. I'll taste that and I'll be back.
Professionals.
Yeah.
We're professionals, and we can spot the tasters.
Mm-hmm. How much would you say in the way of tasters, would you say you give away in a year?
Oh, we give tasters a very small amount.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it really amounts to much. If I were to add it up and try to come up with a figure of how much we gave to tasters during the year, I would say maybe 5 or 10 pounds.
Oh, that's at $40 a pound. That's
yeah, right. Yeah, but you're talking about over a period of a year.
Okay. Well, you could do with that at Yom Kippur or some other great holiday. An extra couple of hundred would come in handy.
Oh yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
How do you take care of your knives?
Well, we sharpen them on steels constantly during the day, and we have a professional knife sharpener come in every 2 weeks. He takes the knives, sharpens them, brings them back, and we keep them sharp with a steel. And they have to really be sharp. In order to do this job properly, you need a sharp knife, a steady hand, and a love of the craft. You have those three things, you can do it.
And do you have a favorite knife?
Yes, yes. Everybody at Zabar's have their own knives.
Yeah.
And when somebody takes you a knife, there's hell to pay.
They won't know, it might end up in their back.
Oh, yeah. It's fun. Yeah. And I'm surrounded by great people. I love the customers. I love the people that I work with. When I started there, there were three Jews and three Chinese guys. Mm-hmm. Now, almost everybody is Hispanic except me.
And Jerry.
That's really wonderful.
Oh, Jerry's retired. Yeah.
That's really wonderful because as a youngster, I never knew many Hispanic people. And now I know a lot, and they are wonderful people, and I so enjoy being with them. It's really wonderful.
Could you take on the job of a moil if you were retired from doing locks?
Take on a job as a what?
A moil.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think I specialize in dead fish.
Could we tell people what a moil is, Len?
I think if you want to tell him, you can tell him.
Well, it's a man that performs circumcisions.
That's right. Oh, Malachi, you really got it down.
Oh, absolutely. I think, of course, you know, we're all Jews anyway. I mean, just because they sprinkle water on your head doesn't change that fact.
I'll bet it doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay, Len, well, thanks for checking in today. It was very enjoyable.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Okay.
Great to talk to you, Len.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're listening to WBAI, and what I always like asking Corey at this point is, how did you find this guy? Because it's always an end run. Someone talked to someone, or someone called you, and you might be interested in this. And how did you come about this story?
Well, you know, in the last couple of years, I had seen a couple articles of you know, kind of veteran fish cutters at Zabar's. Slicers, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I got to watch my P's and Q's here, my guy. I knew that the high holidays were coming up, and I had called up the Zabar's and asked about it. And, the crux of the article was that they do bring a few retired guys back. Now, Len, he's only partly retired. He works 2 days a week. But this is the busy season for Zabar's and for cutting, and they get a real rush at the counter. So we did a story about how one guy comes back from, they fly him back from the Dominican Republic, and another fellow comes in from Queens, one of the actually old Chinese immigrant he was talking about. They used to have Chinese cutters there too, and one of those fellows comes back in out of retirement. They pull him out of retirement because you can't just walk up to a counter, and if you've cut a few, you've cut in at a deli or something, this takes training and it takes months and months if you even have a steady hand. I mean, you can't just pull people off the street and have them cut locks. So they bring back guys who have worked there before. So that was the kind of gist of the article, and really just to be honest, a way of getting into this really cool culture there, this counterculture there.
But I just envision you calling Zabar's and saying, like, hey, I'm from the New York Times. Next. Like, they must have gotten so much coverage over the years, and it's such an iconic place coming down Broadway. I remember I had some Columbia student, and she was talking to her mother. Oh, Mom, I'm going to my favorite place, Z-Bars. And I'm like, oh, my God, you have not been here that long. And she was heading down to it. But I guess they wouldn't be impressed. There must be articles all over and everything covering that place.
Right, but at the same time, they're not sneezing at it. I mean, they're not turning it away. I mean, what does it take? All they have to do is let me come in and talk to their employees, and it winds up being. But a place like that, a place like Katz, is all these places that are institutions. I mean, they don't need. I mean, they generate enough press just by staying in business. You
know? Well, Carnegie Deli is closing down. After how many years?
I don't know. A long time.
80 or 90 or something like that. That was an institution. With their great big sandwiches and so on.
Right.
Well, it's all changing. I mean, even Katz is downtown. The whole block is gone now. Katz is just remaining, and they've sold the air rights over. So they're building these huge luxury buildings over Katz's. And it's hard to even get into Katz now. There's all these tour buses that pull up. And they don't know how to yell at the guy to get a pastrami on rye. You know, when you go in there and try to order, you got to be on your game. You got to get up there, and they're looking around, and this is nice, and they don't know what to order, and what do you have? Yeah. And you feel like shoving them out of the way. Listen, you know, get out of the way. I want to order here. But
I was talking to a friend of mine, and he went into, I forget where it was now, which one. I think it was Katz's anyway. Right. And he ordered a lox on a bagel, with the usual fillings. And a man he was doing business with. So he invited him. He thought, you know, show him a bit of New York. And so anyway, the guy ordered, he said, oh, I'll have that that salmon thing. What do they call that? A lox. So he ordered that. And then the waiter came and he said, He said, what do you want to drink? He said, oh, I'll have a glass of milk. And my friend said, that was it. You
that milk? Or butter.
That was that was the end. He said, I couldn't do business with the guy who would drink milk with lox. He said, I was shocked. He said, he was such a rube. And that was the end of it.
Well, if you want to continue hearing New York stories about Woody Allen's mother and about Z-Bars and Katz's, you have to call 516-620-3602. You can get two books, Exile on Bridge Street by Amy Lynch, who's sitting here taking in all the stories, probably trying to figure out the third book, how he's going to incorporate it, and Angela's Ashes for $100, the 20th anniversary. Or you just can donate and just show appreciation for the 2 hours of New York stories that we do every Wednesday here from 10 to 12 o'clock. You can call and donate any amount, and I mean any amount. We've had people, I remember on Radio Free Aaron, we had Carol O'Connor call up and donate $2,000 one time when he was out in Queens, because he's from the Woodside, Sunnyside area. And
I have a story about him.
You know what? I say to Corey, can you get anybody that Malachi hasn't met? You know, because no matter who Corey writes about, the guy will get on. Malachi, do you remember the time? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I don't think any Rolodex is capable of that.
Well, go ahead. Now you've whetted my appetite. What's your Carol O'Connor story?
My Carol O'Connor story is this. At one time, I was a fairly regular guest on the Tonight Show, when Jack Parr was the host. And so one night I was on with Jack Parr, and the next thing Parr, he was the host before Johnny Carson, he said to me, there's a very famous man here who wants to talk to you, and are you on for that? And I said, well, if a famous man wants to talk to me, I'm on for that. So then he said, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to present to you a man who has been in Hollywood for years and a very famous actor, never given a bad performance, and here he is, Burgess Meredith. So Burgess Meredith was very famous. So Meredith came on, and he said, I have been looking all over town for you. And I said, really? I am listed, and I had Malachi's at the time, the saloon. And I was in my saloon. He said, well, somehow or another, your phone wasn't working. But here is the situation, he said. I am directing an adaptation of James Joyce's Ulysses. And I have already got the cast together, but I am looking for the man who was James Joyce's best friend in the Howth Tower in Dublin when he was a young man. And he says, stately, plump Buck Mulligan. Also, his real name was Malachy Mulligan. And he said, I would like you to play that part when this show comes on off-Broadway at the time. So he said, are you available? I said, well, I have a bit of a conflict, but I would like to see the script. And he said, very good. Here is the script. It is yours. The part is yours. And that is that. So I took the script, but I couldn't do it because I was already doing a play with the Irish Players, and I was doing Playboy of the Western World, already committed to that. What I didn't know was that Burgess Meredith, in a very unethical move, had already offered the part to Carol O'Connor, and Carol O'Connor had accepted the part and was ready to do it. He was an unknown actor at that time. So anyway, then Burgess Meredith, then of course, when I told him I couldn't do it, he reverted to Carol O'Connor, and Carol O'Connor did the part. Now, by a remarkable coincidence, Carol O'Connor was writing for his family's newspaper. I think it was the Irish World. Isn't that correct?
Right. Yeah, the Irish World.
The O'Connor family. So anyway, he was also doing some theatre reviewing. So with the Playboy, the Western World, we got the most astounding reviews that you could ever, all the papers at the time, there were 8 of them, gave us superb reviews. Carol O'Connor reviewed Playboy, the Western World, that we did, and he gave us an astoundingly bad review. He criticized everything. He said it was a lousy production, their accents were terrible, the action was rotten, the costumes were inaccurate, and he went on and on and on how bad the whole thing was. The thing was that he blamed me for seeking the part that he got. And he thought that, but he didn't blame Burgess Meredith for that. In his autobiography, in his memoir, he talked about what a great friend he was of Burgess Meredith and never mentioned the fact that he had been disenfranchised of the part of stately Buck Mulligan, and that the part had been offered to Malachy McCourt. I was coming down on the elevator in the Shelbourne Hotel in Dublin, and the elevator stopped, and who should step in but Carol O'Connor. And I said, hello. And he looked and gave me a look that was a killing look. I said, look, it was not my fault. It was your bloody friend, Burgess Meredith, that offered me the part. I said, I did not know you had been already. He said, it's water under the bridge. So he said, would you like a drink? And I said, are you buying? He said, I am. Okay, I said. So we went to the bar. I was drinking at the time, of course. Mm-hmm. And we went to the Horseshoe Bar at the Shelbourne Hotel. And we had a couple of drinks. And we became quite good friends after that. Mm. So that was until he died.
Carol O'Connor story.
Yeah.
A New York story, yeah. Via Dublin, via the Jack Parr, via television.
Oh, we were flying high in those days.
Man, oh man.
I met somebody at one time. I knew you, this woman said, when you were Malachy McCourt. So there we are. So that's my Carol O'Connor story. Isn't it amazing?
Oh,
he's small. Man. If you live long enough that you get to meet Lox Slicers and Archie Bunker.
And I just want to remind our audience, if you want to meet Malachy in the flesh, on Monday night he's going to be at Rosie O'Grady's. I think it's from 6 to 9.
Right.
Being honored by the Irish American Writers and Artists. Just type in Irish American Writers and Artists. Get a ticket. It'll make you a member of the organization. If you have any talent in any direction, it's one of the greatest organizations here in New York, and you get to meet Malachy and a couple of his friends next Monday night at Rosie's.
We're expecting young Ed Burns. He's looking at his shooting schedule. He's doing a movie. And Kate Mulgrew and Taylor Schilling, the two stars of Orange is the New Black. Is that what they say?
Yeah, that's the big hit show.
And David Amram, the great David Amram, will also be there playing, definitely for sure. And Peter Quinn, the great writer. We all know Eamon, right? Mm-hmm. And so there we are. So you never know who's going to show up. And a whole family of mine, and you know, McDonough and Lynch and Kilgannon. You never know who's going to get in the
door.
Sounds
like the signatures of the proclamation you were going through there.
That's right.
And then also on two nights later, I think on October 19th, Wednesday, we're having the salon at the Cell for Irish American writers and artists.
Yes. I was talking to Corey coming down, Eamon, on the origins of the term lynching.
Uh-huh.
And now there are various tales about lynching. What is yours?
Mine is that it did not come from the Carolinas. It came from about the 1200s.
Galway.
In Galway City.
Yes, right. That was mine. Yeah.
There was a... a governor or
mayor,
some,
the mayor of Galway,
mayor of Galway City at the time, had a son, and his son fell in love with a local girl, but the local girl had fallen in love with a Spaniard, and the son killed the Spaniard, threw him in the ocean, and the father was forced to hang his own son.
No, but the son was so popular. Here was the thing about, you know, a little addition to that, if you don't mind, Eamon. There was a system there at the time of fosterage. And so the mayor's son had gone to Spain to live with the Spanish boy. And the boy, Spanish boy came to Ireland to live with the mayor. And he, while the Irish kid was away, and of course the Spanish lad fell in love with his lady, and she fell in love with him. And when the Irish kid came back and found that the Spaniard had taken his girlfriend, he, in a fit of rage and anger, he killed him. And then he was sentenced to death by, but he was so popular, so beloved, nobody in the, they could get nobody to hang him. So the mayor himself hung his own son, and that's where the expression lynching came from. But it's very strange derivation, isn't it?
It became very popular in the States here, you know, much later on in the 1700s and 1800s, I think even earlier than that.
In the States. Much later, though, the expression came into being.
Yeah.
Because Lynchburg, was it Lynchburg, Virginia? Lynchburg is. So anyway, that's I love finding out where words come from. Mm-hmm. So there we are.
And Lynch wasn't even originally Irish. It was Norman.
Yeah. Oh, was it really?
It was Norman. Yeah, it's not. Yeah. They weren't originally Gaelics, but I mean.
Well, you have a different spelling.
Oh, well, the Gaelic spelling of it.
Yeah, tell them the spelling there.
That's right, because, you know, it's hard enough to remember my name here, Eamon Lynch, but the spelling of Lynch is actually L-O-I-N-G-S-I-G-H, which is the old word, the Gaelic word for mariner.
Right. Is it really?
For mariner,
I got you.
And, you know, in Ireland, it's usually O'Lynchy.
Yeah.
Or O'Lynchy.
Right. Shashin Cart, as we say. That is right. Yeah. There we are.
Yeah, so if you want to look up Exile on Bridge Street and you see a weird spelling last name, that is correct, actually.
That's what it is. So don't get worried. It is by Eamon Lynch, but it's spelled L-O-N-G-S-I-G-H.
And don't forget, you can get one today for $75 by calling in to 516-620-3602.
Very good, Eamon.
That's it, Malachy. We got about 20 more minutes to raise some funds for this, our beloved station here at WBAI. If you want to hear these type of stories and the type of books that we're talking about, donate any pledge. I just see Sarah from the Irish American Writers Group just donated a little while ago.
Oh,
she
really?
Just texted me. Yeah, she'll Sarah be there Farron. On Monday, Sarah Farron. She's,
she's
I know she's the Upper West Side. I know she's living out in Rockaway here and there. She's doing,
she's
doing the commute.
Yeah, Sarah is a in real estate and quite successful, but also she is a very a very accomplished stand-up comedian.
Yes,
I don't know why people say comedian. Yeah, she's very very funny, very original, and very subtle. You know,
and a member of the Friars Club because she plays for their softball team.
Yes,
in Central Park.
So there,
see
and
her running dad, around the bases.
And her dad is one of great. He's one of the great little writer, memo writers. He sends more. Every time you do something, you get a note from her dad, Stephen.
Is
he's
that
a
right?
Lovely, lovely, lovely man. He just if somebody does something, he believes in letting them know that he knows it and appreciates it. So there you are.
That's more of an old tradition it now is, that people used to send notes and thank you notes.
Michael Judd used
like
to do that. I used to get who was the priest who was killed in 9/11, the first casualty. And I always got notes from him, and I wish I had kept them. They were always written on. He could be a label of something on the back of. You know, all kinds of scraps of paper Michael Judge would send. And then, of course, he was the chaplain to the fire department. He was one of the few priests that I am friendly with. Brian Jordan is another one.
Well, it sounds to me like you're hedging your bets there. You know what I mean? You want to denounce the religion, but you want to keep a few priests in your back pocket just in case. you just never know, you know?
Well, people are always telling me, when you are dying, you'll be screaming for a priest. There'll be no point in me screaming for a priest.
Speed the process along.
Yeah. Why would I scream for a priest? Where the hell are they going to? Where are they going to provide me with some kind of a conveyance to get me to wherever I'm going? Right. Because I mean, if there is, there is no such thing as heaven or no such thing as hell. But can you imagine heaven? The reward is that you sit for all eternity gazing at God. Mm-hmm. Now. And everybody's sitting at his right hand, they say. So they're right. There's 5 billion people have died. Now, maybe there's about 2.5 billion, if you would count. 2.5 billion are gone down, and 2.5 billion are gone up. And so they're sitting at the right hand of God. And they have to look left, you see, and craning their poor necks, looking at God, and way over on the left is going to be me, because I do not want to sit at the right hand of God, and I don't want to be, but I will be the only one at the left hand of God, if there is such a place. But I don't anticipate there will be. Death is simply a final sleep, and that's all there is to it. Now, the one of the rewards of being canonized a saint is that when you are a saint, according to Saint Augustine, that you have the privilege of sitting, and there's a trap door that you can look down into hell. And one of the things, you can witness the punishment of terrible sinners. So there you are sitting in heaven, and you're having this vision, this motion picture of millions of sinners running around, being chased by little devils with little red hot pitchforks, sticking them up the arses of sinners, and them screaming and roaring and shouting and repenting, and they're saying, "It's too bloody late, you little bastard. Take that and take that and take that." That's madness down there. So the thing is, don't go to hell. No. It's not a pleasant place.
And if there is a God, he's going to be calling 516-620-3602.
I mean, Malachy's so dedicated to this station, he's actually writing a book so we can use it as a premium in February when it comes out. And the name of the book, Malachy?
Death Need Not Be Fatal.
There we go.
Well,
W-B-A-I.
I think you should start writing faster. Yeah.
I was going to call it Tales from the Departure Lounge because at my age, it's you're in the departure lounge and you're just watching it, and it's a day at a time, because I don't know. I mean, if I get home today, and if I don't drink, if I don't smoke, if I eat properly, do a little exercise, and get a little nap, I will have a terrific healthy. I will die healthy if I die by midnight tonight. Mm. So that's the way it is.
That's
so that's
going forward to, huh?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, yeah. And I'm thoroughly well. It's a day at a time. That's all there is to it. No matter who we are, it's only one day. So off we go when we go, and that is it.
And the number here to hear New York stories, and we're going to cover a real New York story that Corey wrote about. Is was it a New York character or a regular story?
It was a regular story. Right. Yeah, last week. It was.
You know what? I just looking at you, you hesitate. You go, "Good God, I write so many things. I don't know if his story." He could have been a New York character.
Well, they're about people. But this fella is interesting. He is an interesting guy. He works at Queens College in the drama department. He's a Shakespeare guy. He's into a lot of things, and one of them is baseball. another is genealogy, and both of those interests led to this project he calls the Hall Ball, and which is he's trying to basically contact every member, living and dead, who's been inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Now, what does he do? He takes the ball around to take pictures or autographs? What is it?
Well,
it's
not
is
really
it one ball?
It's pictures, really. He doesn't want the autograph. For every living member, he visits the member, gets him to hold the ball for a photo, so he gets the ball in their hand. And there are many more deceased members, so he'll go to a gravesite, or if they, some of them don't have gravesites, either for various reasons. Either they were cremated, or was kept private by the family. He'll go to the closest kind of most interesting connection that they have. For example, everyone knows that the slugger Ted Williams chose to have his body freeze dried.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah.
His head was
freeze-dried.
Right.
Yeah. So in case they come up with a way to revive people.
Just keeping ahead of things.
Yeah. So he visited that what the heck do they
call it?
Cryogenic?
Yeah. It's a preservation.
At the end instead of 7-3. We're just looking it up there.
2-3.
Yeah. All right. We're going to get them on right now.
We're calling him now.
So what if any of them, the dead ones, speak? What will he get them on tape or something?
Yeah, I guess he'll have to adjust the tally. Yeah. So, yeah. His tally right now is, so there's 312 members of the Baseball Hall of Fame.
How many?
312.
Yeah.
He has 287 so far. So he's got about a dozen living and a dozen dead to get. But a couple of the living guys are not exactly easy to get. There's some of the, you know, some legends. Mm. And so we'll ask Ralph. Ralph, are you on with us now?
No.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ralph, are you there?
I'm here, guys.
Oh, yeah. Back. Thanks for coming on. I was just telling the fellas here and the listeners about your project, the Hall Ball. You're trying to get form a connection and using this old baseball between all 312 inductees into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And you've gotten most of them. And you have about a dozen living and a dozen deceased to get, and the living ones, it's not exactly going to be easy to get these guys. And we'll get into a little more of the background in a minute, but just talk about who do you have left that are living legends, living inductees into the Hall of Fame, and how do you plan to get some of these guys? You know,
well, sure enough, the guys who are left are the ones that we call legends. You know, it's folks like Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and Sandy Koufax. Who, you know, reached that point in their careers where they don't really do the autograph circuit anymore, which is where how I've reached most of the living guys previously. So with my plan, well, I have some form of contact information for all of these guys. So it's letters that hopefully now, you know, thanks to you, Corey, I can send them a copy of your article, and that gives me just a little bit more credibility in their eyes.
Because you don't pay these guys for access, right? A lot of them charge money.
Especially, you know, folks like Mr. Aaron and Mr. Mays, because it is so rare, and, you know, they are legends, they charge astronomical amounts for public appearances that, you know, are way beyond my means. So it's sending a letter to their people and hoping that if they're at the Hall of Fame induction ceremony in July, they're willing to meet up with me, or if they are willing, I'll fly to their front door and I'll go right to them if they're willing to give me that 5 minutes of their time.
Yeah. So this project began about 6 years ago, right? It was a visit to Cooperstown. Just tell us about that and how it started.
Sure. There were two parts that made the story happen. The first one was very simple. My wife and I were watching a baseball game at Doubleday Field, the WPA project that was built in 1939 in Cooperstown, supposedly the site of the first baseball game. We know now that's not true. But we were watching a game there, and she noticed a baseball that had been hit foul and was in the little creek that ran next to it. She ran down and she grabbed that baseball, and you know, we held on to that. Then later that day, we had dinner reservations that we were early for, so we decided to spend a little time in the Lakeside Cemetery on the southeast corner of the lake in Cooperstown, because that's what genealogists do at their spare time, is go to cemeteries. And while we were there, she located a grave for Abner Doubleday. Now, it turned out that it's not our Abner Doubleday, the famous mythological creator of baseball. It turned out to be his grandfather. But seeing Abner Doubleday's name written in stone sort of got me thinking about the grave sites of the Hall of Famers, and it all just sort of fell into place from there.
And then you started crossing the country visiting the graves and the actual living members themselves, and you had
that's right. Well, I started doing my research on the grave sites, and I heard that there was a gentleman by the name of Stu Thornley, who's he's actually the scorekeeper for the Minnesota Twins, who had done a similar project. He had visited most of the graves of the Hall of Famers. At that point, I think he's visited all of them. There's been a few new ones since then that Stu hasn't made it to yet. So because Stu had already done that, I wanted to do something different. I'm an artist, and it's always about trying to do something different. So I added in the ball and having the ball go on the trip with me, and then I decided to put, you know, that I might as well include the living guys as well. I wanted to create something that was going to unite all of the Hall of Famers in a way that had never been done before. I wanted the living guys to be a part of that.
Yeah. And, you know, it was interesting. When I met you at Calvary Cemetery in Queens, not far with John's neighborhood, we were going to this. It's a bit of a potter's field in the cemetery. These people were buried decades ago, parishioners, and they were indigent and unclaimed bodies and buried with the help of the Catholic Church. And one of them was Cristobal Torriente, the Cuban Babe Ruth, who you found out on a trip to Cuba a couple of years ago. You went to this, like, kind of baseball's Arlington in a way, right? I mean, it's their big cemetery, and his name is on one of the big memorial markers. And then someone pulled you aside and said, he's really not buried here. And then you found out through records that he was buried with no headstone in a mass grave in Queens. So that, I mean, that was such a fascinating, when you were visiting, that's when we accompanied you last week, when you were visiting there. And it's very poignant that this project led to a bunch of discoveries like this, where, you know, you found out that these guys weren't exactly buried where they thought, where people thought they were, and some of them didn't have gravestones.
It's been interesting. You know, when I started the project in 2010, there were a number of Hall of Famers who didn't have grave markers. Pete Hill, Frank Grant, Saul White. Now, you know, to baseball fans, these are, of course, all names of Negro Leaguers. That's our unifying thread, is that these were all guys who played in the Negro Leagues. And since then, since I began the project in 2010, all of those graves have been marked, all thanks to a guy named Jeremy Kroc, who runs the Negro League Baseball Grave Marker Project. And it's been an honor to work with Jeremy to help make a stone happen for Saul White in Staten Island, where I live. I live 10 minutes from where Saul was buried. So to be a part of helping that stone happen has been great. And now that we know where Cristobal is, we're working with the cemetery to try and get something placed there. It's tricky with Cristobal, because it is a communal grave. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of people buried in that field. None of them have markers. So it's cemetery policy that no one gets a marker. But we're trying to see if they'll let us put a monument somewhere near the section or something like that, just to denote that he is in that place.
Yeah. You know, since we are in the studio with Malachy McCord, I did wanted to mention, Malachy's always interested. He's not quite the baseball fan, like he's not going to be watching, you know, the playoffs now every night and that kind of thing. But he always is kind of amused at baseball and the terminology, and especially that before we had quote-unquote baseball in this country, going back to the mid-1800s or early 1800s, there was always right bat and ball type of games. And since you're, you know, you produce Shakespeare plays, and you're into Shakespeare and other types of theater, just talk for a second about the history of the bat and ball games and that type of thing. You know?
Well, bat and ball games have been around for as long as there's been sticks and balls, different variations of different games. There's dozens, if not hundreds, of games that involve hitting a ball with a stick.
We called it rounders when we were playing, kids.
That's right. Rounders is one of the ancestors of baseball. Baseball didn't have an inventor. The idea that Abner Doubleday was the inventor is absurd, only because baseball was an evolution. It changed over many, many years, and there are many, many games that baseball owes some debt to. Rounders is most definitely one of them.
Yeah.
And New York, right, has a baseball history, the Knickerbocker Club.
Long history.
Yeah,
New York is, I mean, you know, if anywhere could claim to be the birthplace of baseball, it could be New York City. There's a historian named John Zinn who actually refers to New York City as the incubator of baseball. Because, you know, those seeds were perhaps generated in other places, but they really grew in New York, in Manhattan at first, and then once, you know, the building started to come up and we ran out of room, it got pushed over to Hoboken. But yes, baseball, as we know it, it was known as the New York game. There was a New York game and the Massachusetts game, which was another game that was very similar to baseball that was developing simultaneously. And the New York game, in the end, ended up winning the hearts and minds of the populace, and that's the game we play today.
Uh-huh. Okay, Ralph, well, thanks a lot. We're doing some fundraising here, so, I mean, great to have more time with this. But if anyone wants to look more into Ralph's project, Google The Hall Ball. The Hall Ball.
Yes.
And and they'll see more about that. So, Ralph, keep doing what you're doing, and thanks for calling in.
And Corey, it's always great when you cover sports because it's not, you know, pitches and innings. It's always a weird twist to whatever. When we covered tennis there a little while ago, and now baseball, it's certainly not the Pope, Mike Francesa, or Mike and a Mad Dog. It's a little different, a little history, a little things going on. And if you want to hear these type of stories, donate any amount you can at 516-620-3602. And just donate anything. You can get a book called Exile on Bridge Street or another book called Angel's Ashes. You might have heard of both of them there. One's for $75, one's $100. Hopefully they'll tell you what it is. And just donate anything. We got one more minute. Malachi, why should people donate in this last minute before we're back in November?
Because we will not be back if we don't get sufficient money. And that's all there is to it. Now, if you, as they say, you got to, people say, I got your back. Mm-hmm. Well, the best way is we'd like you to get our front, which is the microphone in front of us every Wednesday from 10 a.m. to noon. And if you don't get our front, then we won't be back. And you can't, therefore, you won't be able to watch our back. So all you have to do is call 516-620-3602. So 516-620-3602. And subscribe. You'll get something back if you do. You'll get us every Wednesday. And thank you, Eamon Lynch. Thank you, Frank McCourt. Thank you, John McDonough. Thank you, Corey Kilgallen. Thank you, Tony, for getting us through all this on the on your various machines there, which are total.
And he did it on one leg. Unbelievable.
He did. Yeah. He did. I saw the crutches. I was wondering.
It's turning into a hospital ward here between Malachi and the walker. You on the crutches?
Not Johnny Walker.
Not Johnny.
There we are.
All right. Well, listen, everyone that donated, thanks. And see you in November.
Give us a call.
Yeah, I'm up at Brooklyn, now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to De Niro, but I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra, and since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem, all of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Brought me back to that McDonald's, took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down 8th Street, off-white Lexus, driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm up at Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my tie. Sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets, give me high fives. Nigga, I be spiked out, I can trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I'm most definitely from
Hi, this is Nando from WBAI's Con Sabor Latino. Please continue to support WBAI by joining us for our annual Salsa Dance fundraiser at SOB's on Friday, November 11th. The four great bands with special guests that are confirmed are Jimmy Delgado and his orchestra, Conjunto Sabor featuring WBAI's own Chico Alvarez, Arturo Ortiz and Siete Con Calle, and the new Swing Sextet, who, by the way, will receive a WBAI Con Sabor Latino Lifetime Achievement Award. We'll also honor Willie Torres, the original lead vocalist and only founding member of the iconic Joe Kiva Sextet alive today. Please join us for this historic WBAI Salsa Dance fundraiser at SOB's on Friday, November 11th. For more information, visit WBAI.org, SOBS.com, or call 212-243-4940.
Hi, this is Donovan, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.